This is Now Innovating, a research to impact podcast from the Office of the Vice President Research at the University of Calgary with Dr. Preetma Chadha and Jordan Witzel.
And welcome back to another episode of Now Innovating, a Research to Impact podcast. We are flying through season one.
So fast.
Yeah, it kind of has come and gone as we sit here in episode nine now.
I'm excited to meet Dr. Aleem today.
Absolutely. Aleem, a really big guest for us to talk to today as far as public policy and health is concerned. We're going to dive deep in just a minute, but I would like to make that acknowledgement. We are in a creative space that is on the traditional territories of the people of the Treaty 7 region in southern Alberta, which includes the Blackfoot Confederacy, comprising of the Siksika, Piikani, and Kainai First Nation, as well as the Tsuut'ina First Nation and the Stoney Nakoda, including the Chiniki, Bearspaw, and Wesley First Nations. The city of Calgary is also home to Métis Nation of Alberta, Region 3. As Preetma tipped us off, Dr. Aleem Barwani joins us today. He's the Director for Public Policy and Strategic Partnerships with the Cumming School of Medicine and the Lead for Public Policy at the O'Brien Institute for Public Health at the University of Calgary. He's a specialist in internal medicine with graduate training from the Harvard Kennedy School of Government in Public Policy and Public Administration. Aleem was a recent resident of the Venture Incubation Program at the Harvard Innovation Lab. And while we're talking about innovation, we've got to invite someone like you on. Thanks for joining us, Aleem.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the O'Brien Institute. Let's jump right in. What is on the leading edge of what you're doing at the Institute right now?
The O'Brien Institute is a fascinating place because it's willing to take risks to do things that others aren't, that others won't do, or others just simply can't do. And I think the O'Brien Institute really sees our role as a public university uniquely, as stewards of public good. And so I think there's a really important question of how do we choose to show up in community? And in showing up to community in different ways, how do we begin to bring together scholars, policymakers, civil society stewards towards collective innovation and policy outcomes?
We've talked with previous guests about minimizing risk in order to get collaborators on board, partnerships in innovation. How difficult is it to minimize that risk when it comes to public policy? You have so many different perspectives, social perspectives coming into implementing something in public space. How do you diminish the concerns around risk when that is involved?
The first step is to not see it exclusively as risk. I think in any situation where there is that tension and conflict, there is the opportunity to create something new and higher level that connects those diverse perspectives into a higher order output that actually serves those multiple stakeholders. And I think in order to do that, you first need to recognize who those diverse opinions are and where they rest, and do we have them included? Then we have to respect that those differences exist. So you have to acknowledge that they exist, they have a right to exist, whether or not we agree with those positions. And once you've recognized and respected those diverse positions, then you can move towards admiration. And under that thread of admiration is where we begin to value difference. And so I think by focusing not on the differences, by focusing not on what is the conflict pieces exclusively, by looking at what are the underlying values or perspectives or history or experiences that lead to those different perspectives, and then from that base, bridging towards how do we do things differently together, back to that notion of common purpose that serves all those different parties as well. And I think if you draw on Roger Martin's work on integrative thinking, you know, you look at who are the best performers in business, in nonprofits, in any leadership role, it's people who can take two seemingly opposing ideas and pull them together, let them rest in conflict in our minds, and then be able to then come out to a third higher purpose, a third more value creating opportunity on the other side.
There's a lot there. And so much of it is like jumping around what COVID is in that public space, really, if we want to pull a real world example to it that we've been living with, is something I think we've all been missing out on. It is that inclusion and respect and bringing opposites together in order to really have steady public policy. Is that, am I on point?
Yeah. And so I almost think of it like a puzzle, right? Every piece has another interlocking piece or pieces. And so it's not necessarily saying the complete opposite on one end, right to the other opposite, the other end, and try and like mash those together. But it's drawing those pieces. Every piece has another interlocking piece. And how do we find those pieces so that they can begin to understand each other? And once you've bridged that little divide, then you can sort of begin to bridge the next divide. And overall, you then begin to see that tapestry. You get to be able to see that overall image of what we need to do. And also recognizing that it's okay at times to have different rules for different people and different contexts. And so, you know, how do we stay open to a wide range of different possible outcomes, that it's not a one-size-fits-all. And the needs of a rural Albertan are different than the needs of an urban Albertan. That might be different than the needs of an Indigenous community, might be different than the needs of a newly arrived community or different. So, I mean, I think we have to be able to actually, again, back to that recognition. If you recognize what differences exist, we can begin to understand what those different needs are, and then begin to be able to meet them where they are and what those outputs look like.
It's interesting. You come to the table with a beautiful intention that you've set in terms of collaboration, and especially when you're trying to break down silos. And I can't imagine in public policy that there's often politically charged motivations and personal agendas. And so how have you, or what is your wisdom that you can share with listeners in terms of building those bridges and meeting people where they are while you're trying to move your agenda forward?
I think it's important to understand the context of why this is the way it is and why it feels so much worse now than it did when we were, you know, younger, or, you know, even, you know, you don't have to go even that far back. But I think media has transformed in the last decade, two decades, you know, beyond. We've gone from like a very centralized, vetted, edited news media system to one that is increasingly decentralized and in many ways devoid of any kind of peer review. And I don't just mean peer review in the academic sense where we rip each other apart to make a better product, hopefully, but any kind of looking at and making sure we're being as objective as we can and exploring as many angles of an issue as we can. Also, as the younger generations are continuing to emerge, we're also seeing that they've encountered diversity mostly online, a lot more online than in person. And so, you know, our understanding of each other is different when we do it on Twitter versus when we do it in person, whether you have the opportunity to get deep versus when it's superficial, when they're talking points versus when they're sort of deep value-driven differences, and you can actually understand and see where and how and why people come from where they come from. And I think this all manifests in, if you look at the Edelman trust barometer, trust is declining, and the trust in governments, trust in business, trust in nonprofit leaders, trust is declining. The group that's been relatively spared is trust in scientists. And I think the reason for that is scientists, as dry as we sometimes come across, we are known that we at least come across as honest as we possibly can be. And I think people recognize that. It may not be exciting, but at least they're trying to be as honest and as truthful as possible. And so I think there emerges a few important sort of sub-themes, right? Which is, the university has a very unique opportunity and role to play in stewarding public trust, especially while we wait for news media to reorient. We can contribute through our communications faculties to better support and reestablish a more reasoned news media system. But it also positions us as in a group that can play an important role in facilitating that discourse. So I think to your point then, how does that happen and what are those challenges? We need to think about, how do we establish a clear network of sufficiently diverse groups from across our jurisdiction? But also, how do we think about those who are outside what we traditionally consider our jurisdiction? If you look at macro trends in the world right now, wealth is shifting east. Age demographics are getting younger, especially in the east, especially in parts of the Southern Hemisphere, especially in Sub-Saharan Africa. And so, you know, I think we need to start thinking about, well, is community local? Is community global? And is our global community engagement one of a charitable outlook or one of sort of a collaborative, co-creative outlook? One where this is actually good for all of us and there's opportunities for us to reverse innovate, so to speak, where we can learn from what's happening there, opportunities for us to learn from what we're doing here, but ultimately see each other as stakeholders if we actually look at the big vexing issues of our time you know, whether it's climate change or pluralism, these are global mm-hmm. issues. These aren't local issues. And so we're going to have to be able to curate, convene, facilitate, and drive change locally and globally and recognize that those two pieces connect.
Maybe this is unfair of me to say it this way. That's the rosier side that you paint. To look at to pull a little bit of doom and gloom into it, is it harder for an institute like the O'Brien Institute and the work that you're doing and the connections you're trying to make, that the world has become more of that global community? Does that make it more difficult because people are more willing to jump on differences globally and make it an us versus them thing? And what about us at home? Why are we helping them? Why are we concerned about that policy there and not here at home? Has it become a more difficult process of shifting change in public policy?
I think it's an opportunity for us to serve the public and to serve the public in new ways. And so, yeah, it's a new societal challenge, but isn't that what a university is about? It's about addressing societal challenges and tackling them head on. And so we do. So is it more challenging? Sure. But that's what we're up to here, right? That's why we exist and that's why we're here. And so I think we look at those challenges and say, well, what are the threads in here that we can convert into opportunities? What are threads here that we can actually better understand to just improve our societal impact?
So what type of things are you up to at the O'Brien Institute right now that are making those linkages between the scholars and policymakers and the community at large?
So I think one area to potentially talk about is community water fluoridation. And I think the community water fluoridation issue is interesting because we just finished our 7th plebiscite in 60 years. And it's been close, right? Those plebiscites have been close. And it's not just here. It's elsewhere as well. And so there is a tension between values. There's a tension between perspectives. There's a tension between, even among academics, about different forms of evidence. And so I think Bill Galley sort of led a report a couple of years ago. And as part of that report, we engaged in what we call quiet diplomacy or track two diplomacy. And what we tried to do is meet with proponents and opponents, as well as different players in city council. And the purpose wasn't to convince anyone of anything. And we don't see that as our role as an institute. Our job is not to be activists or advocates for mm-hmm. a single position. Rather, it is to better understand the histories, the perspectives, the experiences of different groups, different communities, and then to be able to use that knowledge to better answer the policy questions that emerge and to better create knowledge that can meet those needs. So through that quiet diplomacy process, it's very interesting. And you could see the discourse shifting during some of those conversations where we were initially viewed as having a very firm opinion at the outset that would never change, to one that I think we were seen as being willing to at least be open to different perspectives, being willing to explore other perspectives. And I think as soon as that sort of curtain dropped, that wall dropped, the discourse shifted. It softened. And I think as a result, you now have an opportunity to talk in depth, to get deep. And again, we talked about the media landscape and how it is on the rather superficial side at times. So this allowed for us to have those deep conversations and allowed us to build relationships with decision makers, with policymakers, with community members and activists on any side. And as a result, it allows you to then begin to think, well, where should the discussion rest? Is this actually a conversation about community water fluoridation? Is this actually a conversation about child health? Is this actually a conversation about academic freedom and discourse? You know, so I think you can now suddenly hold that discussion at a different level where everyone can come in at it at the same point of privilege, like what they all prioritize. And now that becomes a very different conversation. And that's what I mean earlier about stewarding common purpose, is you can go from a fractious item to potentially an item that unites people. And now you can actually decide what's the best way forward to pursue that objective. And I think that's a lot of what we're trying to do here, is how can we use models of quiet diplomacy, models of tractate diplomacy, which aren't rah, rah, rah in the public, you know, big, fancy affairs, but that are quiet, soft, doing important work, building relationships, building trust. And I think ultimately that's what we're talking about, right? Like we talk about failing media, and I think that's really the root, is that these things lead to fractured trust and hostility then emerges. And so how do we build trust as a counterweight to hostility?
I love that approach, quiet diplomacy. I've not heard it tagged in that way, but it resonates with me, and it's so transferable in every industry, and that approach really brings in the diversity and the equity and really including everyone in the process to understand the needs of the entire community. That's a really beautiful approach. Is that something new in the way that you guys are operating?
I think notions of quiet diplomacy have been used with less nerdy language forever, yeah. Right? I mean, people do it. Does it have a label to it? Does it have a practice around it? I think that's where it gets a little bit trickier. Track two diplomacy is a very well-established field in political science, mm-hmm. in international armed conflicts. It's been used in the most recent, the Iran nuclear deal. Mm-hmm. So Peter Jones at the University of Ottawa helped broker a dialogue that led to that Iran nuclear deal. Mm-hmm. Look at the apartheid in South Africa. Track two was very important in stewarding that outcome. But what we haven't seen is the application of track two in public health. What we haven't seen is a systematic installation of quiet diplomacy tools within a public institution like a university to drive that common purpose by including a diverse range of people and perspectives, not just the ones we see most commonly inside mm-hmm. our walls, and using that for us to resolve our most vexing societal challenges mm-hmm. So we can collectively assess and solve problems, right? Mm-hmm. And I think both those dimensions are important. You have to assess it together to get it right, so you mm-hmm. understand we're talking about the same things, and then to then draw on those diverse capacities to be able to actually bring ideas to the table.
That sounds like that's your innovation right now in public health policy at the O'Brien Institute, is implementing that track two diplomacy within your four walls. What has been the biggest barrier in getting those wheels in motion and moving it to the point you're at now?
It's, I guess there's this tension between innovation and research. Research can lead to innovation. Research is innovation. But then there's also what is traditional research and what is traditional innovation. Where do those lines cross? And I think that can be challenging in terms of finding funding. Mm-hmm. That can be challenging in terms of, what are traditionally measurable outcomes and outputs. It can be challenging when you want to then grow something, especially things that are sort of common good focused that don't necessarily have a clear payer. A clear buyer, I guess, would be the most appropriate term there. And so those become more challenging as social enterprises, because one could argue those are public goods that should be funded by government, that should be funded by public institutions. And so now you have to say, well, as a public institution, where are we prioritizing our resources? Where do they go? Mm-hmm. And so you want to fund research. You also want to fund those non-research arms that allow for good research, that allow for really innovative, cutting-edge, trend-setting research that is deep. But there's a sort of back and forth between the research side and the engagement side. And so I think there's always this funding tension as to where do the resources come from in order to facilitate that non-research arm that leads to research, but that also leads to innovation. And you can almost see that sort of self-propagating loop, but you still need to feed that side. And I think in a context of perpetual cuts, that side becomes much harder to support. I'm always hesitant to sort of speak to downsides without speaking to upsides. I mean, I think our campus has been remarkable at creating bridged opportunities for social scientists and public health to intersect. I mean, a lot of what I'm talking about are social science concepts today, and I'm not a social scientist, right? I'm just a schmuck with a white coat, drawing on those social science capacities and insights, and incorporating them into this context is, I think, really special. And our university, I think, has been really good at facilitating that transdisciplinary mindset. And then the question is now, how do we sustain and fund the innovations that need to reside within the institution administration itself, so that this becomes infrastructure that facilitates any number of future research pieces and innovations? I think that's the next piece we need to think about. Where does that resource come from, and how do we sustain that?
Do you think you're at an advantage by being in Calgary, at the University of Calgary, for that? Because a lot of what you said, the undercurrent to that is seemingly that you're in the perfect place for it, just by the spirit of our city in Southern Alberta at large.
I mean, I like to say that we're not a small, big city. We're a big, small town. And I know some people find that sort of insulting in some ways, but it's meant with the greatest heart. Mm-hmm. I think we're truly a collective of people who really care about getting things done, who really care about each other in different ways. And then the question is, how do we make sure we know each other so we can steward those processes together. Because over time, I think we've gotten to know each other less, right? Like if you think of Olympics Calgary, the Flame Stanley Cup Calgary, right? It's a different feel now than then. And I don't think it's because Calgarians have changed. I think it's because we just don't know each other as well as we used to. And so, yeah, like we're a big, small town with a big heart. And I think as we get to know each other, we come together and we always overcome.
So with that in mind, what are some of your big projects and your moonshots that you're wanting to reach out and tap into our listeners for?
There's a few areas I would speak to. So one is, you know, under a broader umbrella of a health policy initiative, under a broader umbrella of like what university community engagement looks like, I think we want to figure out what does a diplomacy platform look like in the university so that we can show up to communities in different ways. And I include rural communities who I think, you know, in a big city, we sometimes forget about all the communities around us and that have equal, you know, rights and access to the products of a university like ours. So I think the first step is creating a platform, you know, resourcing a platform that allows us to convene those diverse perspectives and then work together to understand different societal challenges and then drive outcomes arising from those challenges, whether it's policy innovations, social innovations, new enterprise that can begin to address some of these big picture problems. It's all of those. It's not just one of those. It's a mixture of policy, for-profit business, nonprofit activities that will actually tackle some of our vexing societal challenges. I think that's one piece. I think the second piece is we want to be truly trendsetters. So not wait till there's a big trend that emerges and then we jump on top of it. I think to actually set the trend, I think we need to bring together the insights from community with the insights from academia. And as we pull those together, I think we can position ourselves, you know, and I think there's a process we can follow to do this well. It's hard to sort of outline it in this short sort of session, but I think there's a way for us to do that so that we're ready. And so we have shovel-ready plans for when the moment is right. But having those insights to start is really, really important, because if we wait for the pandemic to hit before we start to act, that's different than if we'd already anticipated a possible pandemic with a one pager and then be ready to jump and just really respond when it emerges. And I think there's ways for us to do that and incorporate those models of thinking and preparation into our day-to-day business practices, you know, within the institution. And I think the third piece is getting deep. And that's sort of been a recurring theme today, is superficial versus deep. And I think the world is zigging, right? The world is zigging, you know, social media, 140 characters. I think we need to zag. We need to get deep. We need to be bringing in groups to have deep conversations, to get deep into understanding different issues. And through that zagging, I think we'll create a whole set of opportunities to lead, to trend set, to bring in the best ideas and perspectives from community, and for us to drive forward together to lead to new research, new innovation.
Has the pandemic been a great test case for some of these thoughts, these hopes, the look toward a different sort of platform and being shovel ready? Is this something that your teams can look back and go, okay, well, we weren't ready for this in the way we should have been, and now we've learned this, and we tried to zag that way, but we should have zagged this way?
I think systems need to be learning systems, and we need to be able to be learning on both short cycles and long cycles. Mm-hmm. So I think we've had opportunities to learn about how we made different decisions within the healthcare system. So for example, when did we implement universal masking? When did we implement, you know, eye protection? When did we implement X, Y, and Z? What, you know, then there's a higher level. When did we shut borders? And how are we learning about this in real time to, you know, look at what is the new evidence, what are sort of historical opinions on certain things, and when do we need to revisit those? So there's those sorts of learning pieces. But then there's like the really long cycle learnings, which is, what was our preparation like? What was our institutional infrastructure support to do these sorts of things? And not only within a city, a province, a nation, but just internationally. And I think we still have, I mean, you know, the pandemic's not over, right? I mean, we still haven't seen, we're on Delta. We've got a lot of alphabet letters in the Greek alphabet left. And I think if the developing world doesn't get vaccinated, we're going to be looking at potentially more vicious and potentially much more vicious mutations. And the second that those variants emerge, I think we're potentially having the same conversation again. And so I think we need to be learning on short cycles, on long cycles, even when those long cycles didn't lead to any negative outcome, right? So the learning system isn't just learning from mistakes, but it's learning from possibilities. And I think there needs to be an element of imagination in those learning systems so that we're not just fixing the problem we saw, but fixing the problems we didn't see. And I think that's a key piece to an effective learning system.
I think on the topic of zagging and going deep as well, perhaps the opportunity that might present itself is what I'm finding. A lot of people are wanting to go deep now, and they have been zigging for too long. And I think society is going through this great kind of reevaluation of work-life balance and what's important to me. It's kind of slowed us down in that way. And so hopefully with that slowdown, we can go a little bit deeper and we can do a little bit more of that work.
I think that's such a great point, right? I think people are hungry for depth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's an opportunity for us to provide that,
yeah,
that forum to get deep. And I kind of wonder if the reason why we've seen advances in the last year and a half on issues of equity is because people have had a chance to get a little bit deeper than they otherwise would have in the busyness of life,
yeah,
right? Perhaps it's also because people's kids come home and they're spending more time at home, where kids then, you know, speak up about what their views of the world are. I mean, I don't know if that's the case, but I just sort of wonder out loud. But regardless, I think it speaks mm-hmm. to your point, which is we're getting deeper in those moments, but this won't last. We need to enshrine that capacity for depth within our systems so that there's a natural forum, a natural place to go to have those conversations.
Absolutely.
I think very indirectly, there is so much applicable in this conversation to all of our listeners, no matter what background they're coming from, whether it be industry or researchers looking for help and outlets. Many, many lessons. Aleem, an incredible conversation. I am eager to just invite you back to season 3 to see where everything you've put out in front of us right now, where it lands in a year's time at the O'Brien Institute. So thank you so much for sharing all of your expertise, your knowledge, your outlook with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We were not going to leave this out. Preetma's perspective, our favorite moment.
Yay.
So much of what Aleem shared is applicable in every space. And one thing he talked about was there's not only a possibility to learn from failures, but there's a possibility to see opportunity in sort of that learning cycle. And isn't that so much of innovation, that you just have to see the next possibility or adapt your possibility as you once viewed it?
Yeah, you're constantly uncovering things. And I think it's iteration. So you go to market with something, or you think you're going to go a particular way. And along the way, you learn of different ways and different means to that end. And so I think that's always interesting, and it's unexpected, yet positive.
In everything he said, there was underlying meaning of value. And he never said it outright. You did. You called it out as those are the values. How important is it to always be aware or become more in tune with your values as the baseline for what you're doing in research or innovation as an entrepreneur, as you're launching or scaling up? How close do you have to hold to your values?
Very close. I think you really need to be passionate about what you're doing, and you're going to have the best success in that way. I've seen many innovators and entrepreneurs in industries that they're not quite familiar with and they're not quite passionate about. And you can see that. It's visible in the conversations. It's visible in the implementation. And so I really think it's all about finding something that we're all passionate about. I'm still thinking about quiet diplomacy and how that impacts everything. And, you know, just as a leader, too. Quiet diplomacy, always listening before talking, seeking to understand and hearing other people's perspectives before even pushing forward your agenda or your innovation. What might make sense to you, and you think, yeah, people are going to like this, and you take it to the people, and maybe it doesn't achieve product market fit. So I think quiet diplomacy is really key in every step of an innovation, to really understand what the need is, because sometimes that need is overshadowed by our passion for the product or the project. Mm-hmm. And we've sometimes put blinders on as a result. So really constantly being aware of different perspectives and checking your bias.
And that's leadership too. I think it's probably the most difficult part of leadership is that quiet diplomacy piece.
It is very difficult.
Thank you for your perspective.
Thank you, Jordan.
The
this
best.
Was fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Great conversation with Aleem and Preetma. Thank you so much.
Now Innovating is produced in partnership with CJSW 90.9 FM from the Office of the Vice President Research at the University of Calgary.